Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. An hour before this program airs here in Colorado, there is another show hosted by Chris Peltz of Holly Street Church of Christ. Chris has recently, with a guest host, Jeff Cox, they have talked about wine in the Bible and their belief that it is a sin to drink alcohol, to drink wine. I don't want to misrepresent what they've said, and I've since done a show here at Bob Enyart Live going through the scriptures and coming to the opposite conclusion. So I'd like to welcome to the studio Chris Peltz. Chris, welcome to Bob Enyart Live.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to be on with you.
It's real good to have you here. So, Chris, if you would, why don't you go ahead and give us an overview of why you say that you think it's wrong to drink alcohol, wine, beer, and so on. Then maybe I'll take a couple minutes to present why I believe the Bible affirms the drinking of wine with alcohol in it. Then we could talk through the scriptures.
Okay, yeah, that sounds great. One of the first things that I think we need to understand is that when we look at the not only the New Testament, but even the Old Testament, not every passage that uses the word wine is talking about something that is intoxicating. The word wine is used for juice even on the grape still. Judges chapter 9, for example, would be a passage where in reference to on the vine, talking about wine, which would be talking about juice itself. But when we do come to the New Testament and we look at the conduct of a Christian, we look at what the scriptures teach and what some of the words mean, I think it's very clear that Christians are to be free from the social drinking, from the drinking of intoxicants, for the effect that it has on us. For example, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, in verses 6 and 7, we are told that we need to be sober. The very word sober means to abstain from wine, to abstain from intoxicants. We have other passages that would tell us, not only from the writings of Peter, 1 and 2 Peter, but also Paul writing in the book of Romans chapter 12 and other passages as well, where we are told that we need to be sober in our thoughts. And not only being sober but and abstaining from wine, but even the process of becoming drunk, which that process begins with the first drink. Ephesians chapter 5, for example, Ephesians 5 verse 18, says that we're not to be drunk with wine, in which is debauchery. And so there, very clearly, the word drunk, according to Vines, is very clearly the process of becoming drunk. Not just drunkenness itself, but the very process in which that takes place. And Peter told us by inspiration of King Jesus in 1 Peter 4, verses 3 and 4, that we have run in the ways of the Gentiles in times past, but we need to move on from that as children of God, as Christians, as he goes on through in verse 4 to say that not only do we abstain and not be caught up in drunkenness, but also in revelries and drinking parties, which is very clearly not just which we agree on drunkenness being wrong, but also we see that we're to abstain from half drunk, which is what revelries really means, and the drinking parties, the kind of the social drinking that is associated with sitting around with buddies having a beer with a pizza or drinking some wine, you know, with some friends at supper time. I think that the banqueting, the carousing that's described in 1 Peter 4, I think that would fall into that very category. And so I think it's very clear that we're to be sober and to do all that we can to remain sober, keep our faculties about us, and not get caught up and give an appearance even of evil. Now, very quickly, as far as absolute abstinence from everything with alcohol in it, that is not something that we've ever said, ever proclaimed. I think there are some instances in the scriptures, New and Old Testament, that would give cause for that.
Okay, well, Chris Peltz, thank you very much for a very concise statement. And you mentioned sober-minded, and of course, drunkenness is a sin. We do agree with these things. I do drink wine, beer on occasion. We might buy a six-pack of beer at our house maybe once every 5 months or so. We might buy a glass of wine every few months on average. And I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church, so there certainly is a lot at stake here. If drinking wine with alcohol in it is a sin, then all Christians need to know that so we could honor God. If it's not a sin, then there's an opposite severe problem, I think, of setting ourselves up as a righteous standard, and then people are not obeying Christ, they're obeying us. The Bible uses the word wine, our English Bibles, about 230 times, translated from different original words in the Greek and Hebrew. The word sober appears about 10 times. The word drunk appears more than 70 times, like when Paul says he lists sins, including envy, murders, drunkenness. There are even words for hard liquor. And the repeated scriptural warnings against drunkenness themselves, I believe, Chris, that those warnings themselves show that God permits drinking wine. And here's why. God doesn't prohibit overdoing something which is a sin to do. For example, God doesn't warn you or me about stealing too much, or too much blasphemy, or too much adultery. He doesn't warn of, we'll get backaches from bowing down to too many idols. He doesn't warn of bearing too much false witness. So warnings of selfishness, for example, don't condemn owning private property. Warnings of gluttony don't condemn eating. Warnings of laziness don't condemn rest. So the warnings against the misuse of alcohol, every time the Bible warns against being drunk, that is inherently a statement that it's permissible to drink wine, but it's not permissible. It's a sin to get drunk. I imagine we may end up talking about the alcohol content of ancient wine in the Bible. Remember Lot's daughters, they were so confident that wine was so intoxicating that they would get their father to commit a heinous, wicked crime, a sin, because they knew wine would get him very drunk. The first man we know of in history to consume wine, Noah, his drink had enough alcohol content to get him very drunk. Jesus talked about in a parable of the Good Samaritan pouring wine in a wound, and that goes back to the days of Hammurabi, 2,000 years earlier, and even the Hippocratic Oath, Hippocrates, centuries earlier, where they recommended pouring beer or dressing a wound with wine. So alcohol was very common. I know that there's the teaching of some, including William Patton, who I've heard referenced on your program, who list ways to stop the fermentation of grape juice, like boiling and cold storage and filtration. And so these methods, while they may have worked, they were unknown in ancient Israel in practice in the Bible. For example, ice, keeping grape juice so cold it won't ferment. If you Google ice in ancient Israel, in quotes, you get zero pages, zero, because there is no biblical or ancient tradition of ice in ancient Israel. People, even to this day, they don't boil wine because you spoil the taste. And you could boil it down to a paste, which was done in ancient Israel. But these ideas, the Bible is filled with references to wine, where God is affirming the use of wine, including in celebrations and making your heart glad, and in warnings against the misuse of wine in drunkenness. So my concern is that when you set up a standard that God himself has not set up, you make yourself the standard, and that is a form of legalism that's very destructive. So, Chris, let's begin the conversation there.
Okay. Well, one of the first things that I would caution you on, the scriptures do, in fact, give warning of having excess of something which is absolutely condemned. Ecclesiastes chapter 17, verse 17, for example, talks about much wickedness. Now, because it condemns much wickedness, is a little bit of wickedness all right?
That's a great proof text for your position. I'll state right on the surface that's a great proof text. The Bible's a big book. It has 1,189 chapters in it, and you could pretty much pull out a figure of speech or a text to prove a lot of things that we might want to prove. Stop the tape. Stop the tape. Hi, this is Bob Inyar. I'm back in studio after the program with Chris Peltz, And I need to retract my concession. After the program ended, I had the time to go back and read in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And what Solomon is doing is he's using hyperbole. And he talks about being overly righteous, overly wise, overly wicked. And he's clearly not using those terms literally. He's using them in hyperbole. You can't be too wise. God is not too wise. We can't be too wise. We can't be too righteous. God wants us to be righteous as he is righteous. So it would be as though somebody said that the Bible says that the Apostle Paul is dishonorable, that he is a fool, and he's weak as his conduct as a Christian. Now, does the Bible say that as his conduct as a Christian, that Paul was weak and a fool and dishonorable? No, but Paul uses a figure of speech in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 10. And he says, we are fools for Christ's sake, but you are wise. We are weak, but you are strong. You are distinguished, but we are dishonored. So it would be misleading to ignore the figure of speech and pretend that the Bible is being literal and saying as an apostle that Paul was weak and a fool and dishonorable. Well, that's what's going on when Chris quoted from Ecclesiastes chapter 7. So we're going to rejoin the debate in just a moment, but I need to retract the concession that I made to Chris. He attempted to refute my argument that the repeated scriptural warnings against drunkenness themselves show that God permits drinking alcohol and wine because God does not prohibit overdoing that which is a sin to do. God does not warn us about too much stealing or too much blasphemy or too much adultery, whereas God's word does warn against being given too much wine, like 1 Timothy 3:8. So when Chris replied that Solomon warned of being overly wicked, touche, right? Touche. I admit it that, Chris, on the surface, that phrase seems to undermine my point. But with the Bible being such a large book, you could find all kinds of phrases taken out of context that can easily become proof text. However, Solomon's use becomes immediately obvious upon reading the passage in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 when he speaks of, do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Do not be overly wicked. Well, you can't be overly good. You can't be overly wise. Solomon wasn't writing prose, but this was poetic verse. If you look at the margins, for example, instead of justified margins where the left and right margin is straight, many translators and publishers use a ragged right margin in the passage whenever they encounter poetry. So that tells you, be on the lookout for figures of speech. So he is using hyperbole, instructing people to act neither to show how righteous they are nor how wicked they are. Don't act to show how wise you are. Do what is right. I doubt that any Church of Christ would urge their members to drink a little wine to avoid being overly righteous. I don't think that would happen. What are you going to do to avoid being overly wise? You're going to promote some foolishness or wickedness? Of course not. Well, the reason I drink beer is to avoid being overly righteous. It's silly, of course. So for Chris to use such a weak verse and to take it so far out of context to try to refute the point helps substantiate the point. Because if the Bible actually did warn against committing too much sin, then he could go to a passage that was direct and clear. So that there are so many warnings against drunkenness in the Bible shows inherently that God permits drinking alcohol because he doesn't prohibit overdoing that which is a sin to do. So now let's return to our discussion with Chris Peltz. The reason I mentioned Bible condemning drunkenness 76 times in my Bible and other condemnations of drunkenness that don't use the word drunkenness is because this is routine with God. God routinely condemns the misuse, the overuse of alcohol.
He does.
But great verse that you, and if you're right, if that verse trumps these other verses, then you're right.
Well, there's other passages as well that kind of show where there are certain things that are condemned in certain instances. I know on your program you've talked about the Nazarite vow, for example.
Right.
And, you know, we look at Numbers chapter 6 and in verse 3 where they were to abstain anything from grapes, which include, you know, the wine, the strong drink. But also with the Nazarite vow, remember Manoah in Judges chapter 13 and his wife was given a prohibition. Now, this is the father and the mother of Samson. And in Judges chapter 13, verse 4, verse 7, and verse 14, there's a prohibition of wine and strong drink.
Right.
But that's not the only prohibition there.
No, even grape juice.
Well, unclean meat. So was it all right for unclean meat to be used by the Jews at any other time? No, of course not. And so even there was a prohibition for unclean meat, not just the wine and strong drink. And so to look at, for example, Leviticus 10 and the Nazarite vow saying, well, they were condemned, they could not use it, but therefore it was okay for everyone else. Well, what about unclean meats? Obviously, it wasn't all right for the Jews to use that as well. Mm-hmm. And so you can't just look at where something is condemned and say, well, if it's just condemned for them, then everything else is all right. It would be like looking at bishops or elders in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and saying, well, they must be the husband of one wife. Mm. Well, can everyone else have more than one wife? No. Again,
well,
keeping things in context.
That is the New Testament prohibition of polygamy generally. Of course, in the Old Testament, God in various ways regulated polygamy. In the New Testament, it's prohibited for all Christians, not only elders, because every requirement of an elder or a deacon, a bishop in Paul's epistles applies to all men. None of us should be given to violence, given to wine. We should all be teachers and honorable and raise our children to honor God. That's a good point. Chris, to respond to what you said, in the Nazarite vow, you take this vow to specially dedicate yourself to the Lord for a period of time, the Nazarite vow. And then the person who does this shall separate himself from wine, neither shall he drink any grape juice, Numbers 6:3. But then it goes on to say that when the period of the vow is over, in Numbers 6, verse 20, after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. You know, we could try to figure out why did God create this Nazarite vow, but the fruit of the vine, it's like blood. It sort of looks like blood. And God, through the scriptures, used the fruit of the vine to symbolize human blood and ultimately Christ's blood shed for us. So by specially dedicating yourself to God and saying, I'm not going to drink, not even grape juice, God is bringing attention to this, to wine, to the blood of the vine, and he's bringing attention to it because ultimately it points to Christ and his blood.
Right. Even there in Numbers, keeping in mind the word wine can be used in reference to juice. We see that, again, Judges chapter 9, for example, talking about the vine and leaving its wine. Again, the vine leaving its wine, we're talking about pure juice. When the word wine, especially in the Old Testament, is used, it's used in two ways. There is a blessing and there is a curse. Mm-hmm. But I would propose that it's not just in the matter of how much is being drunk. But, for example, Proverbs 23 gives, I think, a great deal of insight, verses 29 through 34, where, yes, it talks about those who linger long, but it also says, as a prohibition, don't even look at it because of the effects that it can have.
Don't look at the wine when it is red.
In the cup, right?
And when is it not red?
You well,
know? That's
right?
That's a figure of speech, like
that's
don't
right.
be given to much wine. Don't linger long with the wine. Don't look on the wine when it is red. These are figures of speech that if you give yourself to wine, then you succumb to its influence and you become drunk, and then your inhibitions go down and you disobey God and you obey your flesh.
Right.
So that's how we would see those passages. Chris, how about the many, many passages in Scripture that appear to affirm the use of wine in a context where it only makes sense that we're talking about an alcoholic beverage? There are many passages like that. I don't know if you'd like me to go through some of them and get your take on them, but there are many. On our website at kgov.com/wine, we list many such passages where the context tells us that they're talking about alcohol, not grape juice, and God is affirming the use of that wine.
Well, you referenced a passage, and I don't know if this would be a part of your list, but Psalm 104, verse 15. I don't know if that would be on your list.
I don't have that on this list, but go ahead.
You also mentioned about the blessing or the joy. It makes the heart glad. Mm. That was something that when you look at not only Psalm 104, just the context backing all the way up to verse 10 and going through verse 15, where God is talking about the grain that you would harvest as he sends the rain upon the earth, and really the fruits that are gathered through his majesty, through his creation. And I think in context there, the wine would be that which would be the freshest from the grape. And, you know, I keep referencing Judges chapter 9 and verse 13, because there, when the vine says, "Shall I leave my wine?" it goes on to say that it is a blessing not only to God, but to men. Well, again, in context, it's very clear the wine there is that is a blessing to God and a blessing to men is talking about pure juice, that which would still be on the vine, still within the grape, so it wouldn't be bad, it wouldn't be wrong. So I think that helps set up when we talk about wine, what is that blessing? Is that harvest as God blesses the harvest and that the vineyards that they would be planting?
Yeah, and I obviously, from our positions we've stated, I believe part of that blessing is to use wine at a celebration, at a wedding, to make men's hearts glad. Is there a threshold where if you cross it and you're sinning? There is, and that's true in virtually every human behavior. There's a threshold if you cross it.
And who determines that
sinning.
Threshold?
God determines it, but his spirit in us and the conscience he gave us should help us determine when we've crossed sleep and rest to become lazy. And in each of these things, when we've crossed enjoying a feast and celebrating food, enjoying food as a celebration, to where we cross a threshold and we're committing gluttony. God has given us a conscience, and when we try to reduce these issues like this to sort of mathematical equations, virtually any alcohol equals sin, I think we make it harder for people to grow spiritually, harder to get to know God, become conformed to Christ's image, because we're reducing many spiritual issues to mathematical equations of yes or no, including giving money to church and so on. How about I present some of these passages to you?
Okay.
And feel free, if you'd like to take the reins of the conversation and go a different direction, that's fine also. Jesus drank wine unlike John the Baptist. And remember in Luke 7, he was accused of being a drunkard because he drank wine. And he said that John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine. That is, he was fasting and he would not celebrate. It's not that he didn't eat. And you say, he has a demon. Well, the Son of Man has come eating and drinking. And you say, look, a glutton and a wino, a wine bibber. So Jesus is pointing out, you know, we can't win for losing around here because John the Baptist doesn't drink wine. He's condemned. I do. And you condemn me. There are a lot of passages like this in the context of alcohol, where that's the only context that criticism makes sense.
Well, it isn't, because remember, John the Immerser is one who would fall under Numbers chapter 6, where not only could he not drink wine, but he couldn't drink juice, anything from the grape. He had to abstain from anything.
Where does it say that John the Baptist took the vow of the Nazarite?
Yeah, I don't have that passage.
Maybe Jeff could look that up.
Being in likeness of Elijah, coming in as Elijah, but even in looking at Matthew 11 or Luke chapter 7, 33 and 34, one of the things that is assumed is that this is alcohol, but it doesn't have to be assumed. Because not only does it say that Jesus was eating and drinking, but also it talks about his association. And they were accusing him of guilt by association as well, who he's with, sinners and tax collectors, and those who may be associated with certain things as he was going in and teaching and spending time with them. It wasn't just because of or what he was eating or drinking, but it was also, if you were to finish reading the passage, it would show that it was his association that they were condemning as well.
Well, and recall in Isaiah 53 that the Messiah would be numbered with the transgressors, with the criminals. So the Lord, he just observes the first time, the Last Supper, and they're going to head out to the Garden of Gethsemane. He says this prophecy needs to be fulfilled. So does anybody have a sword? And they say, look, Lord, here are two swords. And he said, all right, bring those. That's sufficient because he's going to be numbered with the transgressors. The disciples were not criminals, but they had the swords for the fulfillment of that prophecy, that association. In this case, Jesus is saying that there is an association. I come drinking wine and I'm called an alcoholic. That seems to indicate that if there were no alcohol involved, Jesus is not going to be condemned for drinking grape juice. In fact, generally, in Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians, there are those who are weak in the faith who Paul says, we don't want to make them stumble, so we're not going to drink wine in front of them. If I'm eating a meal and there's an alcoholic at the table, I will put the law of love into operation, the law of liberty, and I will not order a glass of wine or have a beer because I care for that person. I don't want them to stumble. But Paul speaks of one who is weak in the faith who will stumble if you drink wine in front of him. And how could it be that anybody would generally stumble, the Christians in Rome? How could it be that some of the believers are going to struggle if you drink grape juice? That's not a conceivable explanation of that passage.
Well, it is if you keep it in context. You put Romans 14 along with 1 Corinthians 10. And first of all, in 1 Corinthians 10, for example, verse 21, Jesus talks there about the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. He goes through verse 25 talking about, go ahead and
eat. Some of you are drunk. Go ahead.
But he talks about some of you go ahead and eat meat, but don't ask where it came from. In verse 28, he tells them, if you know that it has come from idols, that it's been offered idols, don't eat it.
Don't eat it for the sake of the one who is weak. For the sake of the one who is weak.
That's right. But notice talking about the eating of meat, but look at verse 31. Don't eat or drink. So we're not just talking about the concept of anything offered to idols and food-wise, and then wine also. We're talking about, in context, not only food, but drink. Because remember, even to the Lord, there were drink offerings.
And so, for one, this passage shows us that when we say generally wine in the Bible is non-alcoholic, this is one of scores of passages that show that's not true, because these people are going to church, they're bringing wine, and Paul says you're getting drunk
at
church.
Well, you jumped ahead. I'm in chapter 10, 1 Corinthians 10. Which is a parallel of Romans 14.
So when Paul then says, look, don't drink your wine at church, don't eat this meat in front of others who are going to stumble because they're weak, implement the law of love, that's another example, Chris, that these things are not wrong in and of themselves. Eating meat that you buy at King Soopers is not a sin, even if the butcher said a prayer to Krishna when he slaughtered the animal.
But the point being, though, first of all, you can't prove that we're talking about alcohol in Romans 14 or in 1 Corinthians 10. The condemnation is the drinking of anything, really, that would have been offered to idols. It's all right when you purchase it and you buy it, but if it's going to upset or bother the conscience of someone because of the past, and that's 1 Corinthians 10, verses 21 through 31. But when you come to 1 Corinthians 11, which you were making reference to the Lord's Supper, beginning in verse 21, really 23, 21 through 24 there, notice the contrast that is being made. The contrast about those who eat and those who drink as opposed to those who have nothing. That's the contrast of 1 Corinthians 11. He's not necessarily talking about they're literally drunk as in going about just kind of, because otherwise he tells them to go and get drunk at home. That's not what he's telling them to do.
That's being woodenly literal with Paul. And if you're woodenly literal many times, you'll take much of the Bible out of context. Right. Paul says, you go to church, and he says, speaking of the Lord's Supper, one takes his supper ahead of others, one is hungry, and another is drunk. And he says, this is wrong. So I don't think he would use the word drunk if they're drinking grape juice. What? And no, he's not saying get drunk at home. He's not saying be a glutton at home. But he's saying this meal shouldn't be taken at church. That's not the point of the Lord's Supper. Right. We're almost out of time. Maybe we could talk about the Last Supper for the last minute. And okay. If you would like, Chris, we could continue this and air it, let's say, maybe a week from today.
Okay, sure.
You'd like to do that? That'd be great. So we'll end in a moment. The Lord's Supper, Jesus instituted that at the Passover, which is in the spring. And the grape harvest is in the summer in Israel. And in fact, the new wine in Acts at Pentecost, they said, well, these guys are drunk with new wine. That's because that was the beginning of the harvesting of grapes. And the grape juice begins to ferment very quickly. So you could get drunk within a short time of harvesting the grapes, but the wine that Jesus served, the fruit of the vine, that was wine that had been harvested the previous summer. And yes, you have extreme measures to go to somehow make the fruit of the vine and so that it will not ferment, but these are unknown in Israel's history, in the scriptures. They didn't boil their wine. They didn't have ice to keep it cold. So we are out of time. I apologize for not finishing that question soon enough. But thank you for this conversation, Chris, and we'll continue.
Oh, yeah, sure. I appreciate it.
All right, super. And God bless you. Check out our website, kgov.com.
Would you like to study the Bible but don't really know where to start? Bob Enyart's seminar on hermeneutics, tools for studying the Bible, will help you to study and understand the Bible on a whole new level. Hermeneutics, Tools for Studying the Bible, is available by calling 1-800-8-ENYART, or you can get the MP3 CD or the MP3 download at kgovstore.com. That's kgovstore.com.